Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. It's our series Bonding with James. We're looking at James outside of the New Testament. In Christian history, there was much ink spilled on papyrus about James. And we're looking at, right now, the Gospel of the Hebrews. We started talking about it at the end of our last episode, but we kind of ran out of time. So just to reset for you, this is quoted in St. Jerome. St. Jerome wrote about the Gospel of the Hebrews. And in particular, there's one part that speaks of James. And it's about what happened after the resurrection. Now, again, this is to be treated with a grain of salt here. It's not part of the Bible. But there are some things we can learn from how the early church looked at James. And so in this Christian writing, post-New Testament, it says this, that after the resurrection, Jesus, quote, went to James and appeared to him. For James had sworn that he would not eat bread from the hour in which he had drunk the cup of the Lord until he should see him risen from among them that sleep. And shortly after this, the Lord said, bring a table and bread. And immediately it is added, he took the bread, blessed it, and broke it, and gave it to James the just, and said to him, my brother, eat your bread, for the Son of Man is risen from among them that sleep. End of quote. So that's the little section from the Gospel of the Hebrews that was quoted in the writings of St. Jerome. Now, this is really intriguing because there's some stuff in here that's probably not historical. I'm going to say it's 100% not historical. This idea that James was at the Last Supper, it says that he had drunk the cup of the Lord. Obviously, that's a reference to the Last Supper. And he almost kind of makes a vow, just like Jesus does, when Jesus says, I will not drink of this chalice again until I'm in the kingdom. And James kind of says something similar, that, hey, I'm not going to do it again. I'm not going to eat anything even until I see Jesus risen from the dead. And then we have an appearance of the risen Lord to James. And this is kind of probably playing off of what we read in 1 Corinthians 15, where St. Paul says that he made a special resurrection appearance to James. And Jesus says to James, hey, bring a table and bread. And he kind of celebrates Mass for him, takes the bread, blesses it, breaks it, gives it to him. And it calls him James the Just, by the way, which he was known by that name in the early church. My brother, eat your bread, for the Son of Man is risen from among them that sleep. So we see here that this Gospel of the Hebrews did kind of arise from a Jewish Christian context, because this idea of Jesus as the Son of Man, that's the early church didn't really talk about Jesus as the Son of Man, because as it spread, as more and more Gentiles came into the church, this just wasn't a concept that they were familiar with. But this is a very Jewish way of looking at Jesus. In fact, this is how Jesus looked at himself. He called himself the Son of Man more than any other way that he referred to himself. He called himself the Son of Man. It's his favorite self-designation, his favorite self-appellation. Jesus goes to this again and again and again in the Gospels. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many, for example, as he says in the Gospel of Mark. Now, this is a very Jewish way of speaking, and it actually refers to a specific book in the Old Testament. We talked about this a little bit in the last episode yesterday. This has nothing to do with Jesus' human nature. A lot of people are very confused about this. They think that when the Gospels refer to Jesus as the Son of God, it refers to his divinity, and when it mentions the Son of Man, that refers to his humanity. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, it's probably backwards. When Jesus talks about the Son of Man, he's probably more referring to his divinity. All Israelites were called sons and daughters of God. So to call yourself the Son of God, it's not that special in first century Israel. All Israelites were seen as children of God, sons and daughters of the King. But Son of Man specifically comes from Daniel chapter 7. This is when Daniel in his night visions sees this figure. Is he divine? Is he human? I don't really know. This one like a son of man. And he approaches, Daniel says, the Ancient of Days. Now, who is the Ancient of Days? That is God the Father. And the Son of Man receives from God the Father a kingdom, power, glory, authority, dominion. All nations, all peoples, all tribes worship him. And his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. So when Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, he's saying, I'm that guy. I'm that guy that Daniel saw. I'm more than a man. I'm something much more. And so the Gospel of the Hebrews kind of uses this Son of Man a reference to Jesus as well, and also this idea of rising from the dead, the resurrection from as coming back from sleep. This idea that, hey, the Son of Man is risen from among them that sleep. Again, it's a very Jewish way of speaking about this, and St. Paul talks about it as well. When he was referencing in 1 Corinthians 15, the famous resurrection appearances of Jesus, he talks about the 500, more than 500, who saw him at one time. And St. Paul says, most of them are still living, although some have fallen asleep. And by that he means that they died. That's it's a euphemism for sleep in the Jewish mind, this idea of falling. It's a euphemism for death, rather, in the Jewish mind, this idea of falling asleep. And so Paul is basically saying, hey, you can interview these guys. You can check it out. Most of them are still walking around. You can ask them if you don't believe me. Did you see Jesus? Did you encounter him physically risen from the dead? And Jesus used this term as well in the Gospel of John when his friend Lazarus dies. Lazarus had been quite ill. And Jesus says to his apostles, hey, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going to wake him up. And they're like, I'm paraphrasing here, obviously, like, what are you talking about, Jesus? What, if he's sick, let him sleep, for goodness sakes. He needs to sleep it off. He'll get better. Let him rest. And Jesus basically says, no, no, you knuckleheads. Lazarus is dead. Okay, Lazarus is dead, but I am going to bring him back to life. So let's go do this. And so, oh, okay, now I get it. So that's one of many, many times that Jesus' disciples don't understand what he's talking about. But again, he uses this euphemism of sleep to speak of death. So once again, in this book, the Gospel of the Hebrews, the leadership of James is highlighted. Peter's becoming more of a figure, you know, in church history with the papacy. St. Paul, obviously his influence is huge, as he has written, you know, about a quarter of the New Testament, at least, St. Paul writes. And so that's a guy to contend with for sure. And so there is a danger that people could forget about James. And so the Jewish wing of the church wanted his memory to be kept alive because, again, he was kind of their pastor in Jerusalem. All right. Well, let's continue on here. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. This is the series Bonding with James. Let's look at some more historians in the early church that wrote about James. First one I want to bring up is Hegesippus. Now, we don't have his writings directly, but he is quoted by another church historian, Eusebius. We'll talk about Eusebius in a little bit, but Hegesippus talks about the death of James, and he adds some interesting flavor. He talks about this incident that happened in the temple with respect to James, which led to his death, his martyrdom. And there's no question that he's probably using the account of Josephus, that great first century, in many ways. He lived very, very shortly after the time of Jesus was in operation in the first century. He chronicled the history of the Jews. He was not a Christian, but he wrote about Jesus. And he's a great source of information outside of the Bible on Jesus and the early church. So Josephus was no doubt the first person to write about the death of James that we know of. So this early Christian writer, Hegesippus, kind of takes Josephus's account of the martyrdom of James, and he embellishes it quite a bit. So I'm going to read what Hegesippus says about the death of James. It's really entertaining, if nothing else. He says, control of the church passes together with the apostles to the brother of the Lord, James, whom everyone from the Lord's time till our own has named the Just. So there's James's nickname again, James the Just. For there were many Jameses, but this one was holy from his birth. He drank no wine or intoxicating liquor and ate no animal food. No razor came near his head. He did not smear himself with oil, and he took no baths. Okay, that sounds pretty gross. Hopefully he was at least wearing deodorant. Maybe he was working on his natural biome, on his skin. I don't know. But clearly, Hegesippus is painting James as a really faithful Jew. He's keeping kosher. He's taking a Nazarite vows here. He's not drinking anything, no alcohol, not shaving his head, all that sort of stuff. So he goes on to say this about James. He says, he alone was permitted to enter the holy place, for his garments were not of wool, but of linen. Now, who wears linen? Just to interject here, who wears linen? The priests. Okay? So it's kind of a reference to the priesthood, if you will, of James 2. So back to Hegesippus here, he says, he used to enter the sanctuary alone and was often found on his knees beseeching forgiveness for the people, so that his knees grew as hard as a camel's from his continually bending them in worship of God and beseeching forgiveness for the people. So there it is, this idea of James having knees like a camel, that's where it comes from the writings of Hegesippus. He's praying so much, he's just getting calluses. All right, let's continue on here. Because of his unsurpassable righteousness, he was called the Just and Oblius. Now, what does Oblius mean? It means bulwark of the people. It also means righteousness. It's a Greek word. So James the Just, James the Righteous, means the same thing. It goes on to say that this fulfilled the declarations of the prophets regarding him. Representatives of the seven sects already described by me asked him what was meant by the door of Jesus. Okay, that's very interesting. So Hegesippus says that, okay, there are these seven sects of the Jews, and that would include, of course, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, all the other groups. There was not sort of one unified way to practice Judaism in the first century. There were kind of these competing takes on it. And so they're asking James, okay, what's up with this? Why are you saying what are you talking about when you say the door of Jesus? What is the door of Jesus? And James replied that Jesus was the Savior. Now, it's interesting that they say this, the door of Jesus, because that's exactly what Jesus called himself. In John chapter 10, Jesus says, I am the door. And by the way, he doesn't mean like a wooden door, you know, like we have in our homes today. This is all in the context of Jesus as the good shepherd. He's like saying, I'm the gate of the sheep pen. And sheep, as we know, don't have a great homing signal kind of implanted within themselves naturally. They just kind of go off, they get lost, and they will follow each other even over a cliff and unto death. So it's really important that the shepherd be the one to gather them to safety. And they will listen only to the voice of the good shepherd. And of course, we humans are like that too. We go astray so easily, don't we? We follow others into doom, destruction, bad choices. We need to listen to the voice of the master, the shepherd of our souls. And what would a shepherd do in the first century? A shepherd would actually lie across the gateway of the sheep pen, and he would sleep there. So he literally would be the door. And why would he do that? Well, in case somebody came, a thief in the night, to try to steal the sheep, he would be there. He'd hear it. He'd wake up. He'd defend the sheep. Or if a wolf comes, same thing. So Jesus is going to protect the church from evil attacks. Okay, so back to Hegesippus for a second. Again, this is an early church historian, and he's sort of embellishing the account of the death of James. And so the seven sects, S-E-C-T-S, by the way, that's how you spell it, all the different groups in first century Judaism. It says, hey, some of them, he says, came to believe that Jesus was the Christ based on James's explanation about, quote unquote, the door of Jesus. But he also says this. He says, the sects mentioned above did not believe either in a resurrection, and that would obviously be the Sadducees who didn't believe in the resurrection or the afterlife or anything like that, or Some of them didn't believe in one who is coming to give every man what his deeds deserve, this idea of the final judgment. But those who did come to believe did so because of James. And just to interject here again, we do know from the Acts of the Apostles and from other historical documents that thousands of Jews in the first century did believe in Jesus as the Messiah before Easter and after Easter. Think about the great crowds that showed up on Palm Sunday to greet him as he rode into the temple precincts on the donkey. Definitely a messianic move by Jesus. And although obviously many of them scattered when Jesus was crucified, many did come to believe again after Easter. We know this. So back to Hegesippus here. It says, since therefore many even of the ruling class believed, there was an uproar among the Jews and scribes and Pharisees who said there was a danger that the entire people would accept Jesus as the Christ. So they collected and said to James, be good enough to restrain the people, for they have gone astray after Jesus in the belief that he is the Christ. Be good enough to make the facts about Jesus clear to all who come for the Passover day. We all accept what you say. We can vouch for it, and so can all the people, that you are a righteous man and take no one at his face value. Okay, so that's interesting. They're basically saying to James, hey, can you please just take it down a notch here? So many people are coming to accept Jesus here. We can't have this. You know, it's the Passover time. This is not cool. And so can you just kind of, maybe not preach so much about Jesus? And they're kind of trying to flatter him a little bit. You're a righteous man, you know, James the Righteous, and you take no one at his face value. It's another way of saying, as Ben Witherington says, this kind of harkens back to the letter of James when James says, hey, don't treat people with partiality, whether they're rich, poor, or whatever. Treat people the same. And hey, they say to James, we know that you don't treat people with partiality. And Jesus did the same. He respected no man. And it doesn't mean he didn't respect people, but it simply meant that he didn't give any human respect. You know, he didn't treat people better who were more popular or anything like that. He just kind of laid it out there for people. So it goes on to say, make it clear to the crowd that they must not go astray as regards Jesus, the whole people, and all of us accept what you say. So take your stand on the temple parapet so that from that height you may be easily seen and your words audible to the whole people. For because of the Passover, all the tribes have come together and the Gentiles too. So they're kind of hoping that he'll stand up there, you know, on one of the high buildings of the temple and say to the people, hey guys, you know, no, Jesus isn't really the Messiah. Well, that's not what happened, obviously. It says, the scribes and the Pharisees made James stand on the sanctuary parapet and shouted to him, just one whose word we are all obliged to accept. The people are going astray after Jesus who was crucified. So tell us what is meant by the door of Jesus. And James replies as loudly as he can, why do you question me about the Son of Man? I tell you, he is sitting in heaven at the right hand of the great power, and he will come on the clouds of heaven. Many were convinced and gloried in James's testimony, crying, Hosanna to the Son of David! Then again, the scribes and Pharisees said to each other, we made a bad mistake in affording such testimony to Jesus. We had better go up and throw him down, so that they will be frightened and not believe him. Ho, ho, they called out, even the just one has gone astray. And that's obviously James fulfilling the prophecy of Isaiah. Let us remove the just one, for he is unprofitable to us. Therefore, they shall eat the fruit of their works. That's kind of interesting, because when Isaiah talks about the just one, he's referring to the Messiah, and they kind of apply it to James, the just, here. Let's go back to the writings of Hegesippus here, this early church historian. So they went up and threw down the just one. Then they said to each other, let us stone James the just, and began to stone him, as in spite of his fall, he was still alive. But he turned and knelt, uttering the words, I beseech thee, Lord God and Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing. While they pelted him with stones, one of the descendants of Rechab, the son of Rechabim, the priestly family to which Jeremiah the prophet bore witness, called out, "Stop! What are you doing? The Just One is praying for you." Then one of them, a fuller, took the club which he used to beat the clothes and brought it down on the head of the Just One. Such was his martyrdom. He was buried on the spot by the sanctuary, and his inscribed stone is still there by the sanctuary. He has proved a true witness to Jews and Gentiles alike that Jesus is the Christ. Okay, so that's the quote, the account of the martyrdom from the early church writer Hegesippus. Okay, there are a number of things that you probably noticed as I was reading this. You might have heard, hey, Cale, I thought that before I talked about James being thrown off of a high place in the temple and then stoned to death because the fall didn't kill him. Now, Josephus did talk about that when he spoke of his martyrdom. James was killed in the year 62 AD. But you probably heard growing up that James was martyred by a fuller's club. Well, this is where that idea comes from. This comes from Hegesippus. And a fuller, by the way, is somebody who would wash clothing, linens, that sort of thing. And back in the days before washing machines, and obviously every machine has an agitator. Well, they didn't have that back then. So he would use a fuller's club, which is kind of like a baseball bat in a certain sense. And he would use that to beat the clothing in a large pail as he was cleaning them. Well, obviously this is used as a weapon to kill James. You also probably noticed a lot of similarities between the death of Jesus and the martyrdom of Saint Stephen that we see in the Acts of the Apostles. Because what happens when James is being killed, James says, "I beseech you, Lord God and Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing," which is exactly what Jesus said when he was being crucified. And then when he is being stoned to death, someone calls out, "Stop, what are you doing? The Just One is praying for you." And so this is, again, kind of an echo of the martyrdom of Stephen as well. Stephen prayed for forgiveness for those who were killing him, and you can read about that in Acts chapter 7, verses 54 to 60. And so Ben Witherington calls this a fuller description of, I think he's probably using a pun there, maybe unwittingly so, of the death of James. And some other interesting things, though, in the account of Hegesippus about James' martyrdom. Again, some of it is no doubt made up, but there may be some grains of historical truth here. First of all, here's what he says. He says that towards the end that James was buried south of the Temple Mount, very near where he was thrown off of a high place on the temple, and he was stoned to death. It says he was buried on the spot by the sanctuary, and his inscribed stone is still there by the sanctuary. Well, this is interesting because, don't forget, we have the ossuary of James, his stone, his limestone bone box. So this may be a historical tradition that got in here. As Ben Witherington says, that Hegesippus claims that you can still see this inscription, his inscribed stone, in his time. And Eusebius published this stuff in the 4th century, so this is obviously still true in his day as well. So if people knew where James was buried, where his ossuary was, this is a place where a lot of the early church would have gone there sort of on pilgrimage to see his final resting place. And the way that Hegesippus describes this, by the way, this is probably the region of the Silwan Valley, which is actually a really old burial site. That's where the ossuary of James was actually found in Jerusalem. So this is really fascinating. It's interesting, too, to note the Greek word that Hegesippus uses for stone, his inscribed stone, the inscribed stone of James. He calls it a stele in Greek. And this can actually mean any kind of inscribed stone. And they found a lot of these inscribed stones through archaeology. One of them I saw in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, this is a fantastic one, It's called Tell Dan Stone. Now, who's Dan and what are we going to tell him? Well, it was found in a place called Tell Dan. Tell is kind of a hill. And this was a really ancient inscription from an Assyrian king that verifies in stone the existence of David and his kingdom. This king brags about defeating the armies of the house of David. This is from roughly the time of David, about the 10th, 9th century BC. And this is amazing because a lot of biblical scholars, a lot of historians thought that the Bible was simply making up stuff about David, that he never really existed. Well, we have this stele, the stone inscription, that talks about the house of David right there. He was a real historical person. This was a huge blow to those who are biblical minimalists who want to say, most of this stuff, you can't trust it. I've seen this thing with my own eyes. This is incredible. It's called the Tell Dan Stele. And so this inscribed stone, this word stele, is also used to speak of the ossuary of St. James. And there are many, many writings in history that say, you can talk about a bone box like that. There are sarcophagi, these sort of stone coffins that have been carved out of rock and inscribed. They're also called steles in history. And bone boxes like James's are called this as well. So it's kind of intriguing that Hegesippus, in writing about the martyrdom of James, may have also tipped us off to the fact that, he was known to have this ossuary, this bone box, and people used to go and see it. They knew where it was buried, and they would go and venerate the bones of the saint. All right, we've got to leave it there. You've been listening to our series, Bonding with James, right here on Relevant Radio on The Faith Explained. If you've missed an episode, you can check out the podcasts. You can find them on the show page at relevantradio.com, along with many other episodes from other series that we've done. You can also find them on the Relevant Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can share them with a friend. Please do so, because most people find out about our shows through word of mouth. You can also follow me on Twitter at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. If you have a question or comment, you can email it to faith@relevantradio.com. That's faith@relevantradio.com. I'll be back later today, live on Relevant Radio for the Cale Clark Show at 5 p.m. Central. I'll see you then. I can't wait. And I'll see you in the next Faith Explained for more Bonding with James.